And we are back with an all new episode, all new year of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Vertel. And already on social media, we're calling it season six. I guess it's year six of the podcast. I just want to say that I think the most famous season six in television history is Saturday Night Live. And that's when they almost got canceled. So look forward to that.
The most famous in history, Louis.
I don't know if you, I haven't seen like the official ranker list of season sixes. Well, I guess Sex and the City season six is probably notable too. But season six on SNL was when Lorne Michaels left and then Gene Demanian came in. And then the only two people from that year that survived for the following year were Eddie Murphy and Joe Piscopo. And everybody else was cast into a dungeon that Lorne has the key to.
I am currently rewatching Sex and the City.
Oh, really? I every once in a while just fall into it because it still is on E in like 13-minute segments.
Right. So it'll still be on. And I feel like that's usually how I've consumed it since high school, college, where I bought a bootleg box set from Japan.
It's not pink there? Is it like deep fuchsia or something?
And the episodes are like very much whatever order was going on. But now I'm rewatching, you know, as part of my return to New York, which is very cliche. But I'm also realizing that I've never really watched them in a complete succession like this instead of just popping on a random episode or just like deciding like, oh, I want to watch this episode from this season. So it's you know, people always bring up that first season where it's a lot of talking to the camera, etc. But I also want to point out, in the first season, Carrie has a lot of male friends.
Oh, that's right. You're totally right. I forgot that about that aspect of the show because, of course, I didn't seek it out at all. I simply wasn't interested in it.
But, you know, it's sort of like she knows so many people in New York to interview, and it feels very, you know, it feels like there's a lot of people and a lot of things going on. And then, of course, those people all vanish. So
she's a connected reporter. It's very She Said, if you will.
Speaking of She Said, I'm kidding. I have nothing to say about She Said.
I'm gonna
I
say,
haven't seen She Said.
You have a new Weinstein take? I was curious. Yeah.
Weinstein, innocent.
And I have the receipts. And it would have to be quite a few of them.
Actually, our guest this week is Georgina Chapman.
Oh, you know what? I missed when she would guest judge Project Runway. In fact, I've been thinking about Project Runway for a specific reason this week, and I'll bring it up when I get to my Keep It.
Oh, okay. That's exciting. But no, She Said, of course, is a film that is allegedly in awards contention
it's sort of in the third orbit of awards contention. If they don't get to the other two orbits, maybe they'll consider the third one.
But we are going to get into the films of the year.
Jesus, there are so many we watched over break. By the way, I just want to say, I never want to take this much time off of again. Me just in the dark talking about movies I've seen to myself on Christmas Day. Real bleak. Kafka.
Of course, we're recording this on the day of the Golden Globes. So there will also be another second bonus episode coming out later in the day. As you're listening to this, there'll be another one coming out, which will be our Golden Globes segment, recorded after we've actually seen the show, which once again is airing on a Tuesday night.
Bewildering. I just want to say, this is a risk on our part, too, because we're assuming there's going to be something to talk about. And I really don't know what the Golden Globes is anymore. Is it like, it used to be, you know, a drunken spectacle, and it feels like it's now going to be like a very, like, liberal AA meeting. Like, it's going to be a lot of apologizing for what the Golden Globes represent, what they once were, you know. Every award will be on behalf of human trafficking survivors. Like, I don't know what it's going to be.
Okay, but also we're in the middle of a tsunami in Los Angeles as well.
And by that, you mean it's raining pretty hard.
It is like torrential downpour. There's like flooding in West Hollywood, in Silver Lake. It's giving way.
I live in West Hollywood, and I'm looking out my window right now, and the streets, I mean, it truly is giving Winnie the Pooh and the blustery day. I feel like I'm going to see the mayor, you know, rowing by in his leaf.
I don't know why I'm currently in LA for this week, and I drove to see The Fabelmans last night, which we will discuss only because, you know, we saw Babylon at the Grove this past weekend. And right. I felt like Fabelmans is actually a very good companion to this film to have seen. So I'm happy that we'll be able to discuss it later in the episode. But I was like, am I going to make it?
Well, it's LA too. So, you know, when there's raining going on, people just park their cars in the middle of the street and start crying. They just give up, you know. You call your agent and you ask, is it almost over?
So we're going to get into the movies, which is exactly how you want to kick off a new season of Keep It. Although, like I said, this is the first one where we're not talking about the Globes.
I'm upset. Episode. You're right. Because our first actual episode of Keep It, it was like an Oprah-centric discussion of the Globes. Did she win like the Lifetime Achievement Award that year or something?
Maybe, but also people kept talking about wanting her to run for president.
Oh, that's right. It was like a The Rock-esque conversation. Yeah. Dumb. Yeah, remember
that era?
Enough.
Anyway, we also have a wonderful guest this week. The delightful Anna Kendrick joins us.
It's crazy how long we've known who Anna Kendrick is. She was a Tony nominee when she was a child and still hundreds of movies a year. This person is constantly working.
Well, you know, I was also a Tony nominee as a child.
Oh, is that true? Oh, yeah. Billy Elliot, tell me how'd that go.
A Tony's Pizza nominee.
They nominate people down there? Okay.
Anyway, we've got movies. We've got Anna Kendrick. We've got Keep It. It's been so while since I said Keep It to something.
It feels right.
Yeah. So we'll be right back with more Keep It. If you haven't seen it already, you need to check out the stunning artwork for our new podcast, Keep It. We wanted to give a shout out to the talented team who made it happen and helped the vision come to life, including my friend and iconic photographer, Sela Shaloni. Tune in every Wednesday for fresh episodes of Keep It, and don't forget to follow us so you never miss a thing. Grab your cape and strap in, because X-Ray Vision now has 2 episodes a week. Featuring expert guests and unique analysis, hosts Jason, Rosie, and Cody journey their way through the hottest pop culture topics and test your fandom knowledge with panel discussions on your favorite franchises. Get ready for deep dives and more with X-Ray Vision every Wednesday and Friday. Don't wait. Tune in now wherever you get your podcasts. ...2023 is off to a massive start already. First of all, Megan, which is Avatar for Gays,
yes,
is out in theaters, and it's one of the many movies that we caught up on over our break. So we're going to catch up on everything that we've been consuming. And I think it's only appropriate that we start with Megan, which is not an awards contender, but maybe should be.
I'm going to say, it's not awards I follow, but maybe somewhere down the line, you know. I really do think there should be a best January release Oscars, where it's just, you know, the new psychological horror movie that's like 2.5 stars versus the new James Marsden movie versus, you know, just the things that are like not in contention for the real thing. I'd like to put them all against each other. What rom-com is J-Lo attempting, you know? That gets into the best picture category.
Her current rom-com is her relationship with Ben Affleck.
That's true. And we can't stop watching. Megan, I will say I had some dread going into Megan because something about the promotional materials, like the funny dancing, like her movements and stuff, it felt to me like they had given everything away in the trailer. Like I just knew how crazy she would be. And to a certain extent, I think that's true. I think there's not much the doll actually does in the movie that blows your mind or shifts what you get from the trailer and what the extreme promo campaign has already given us. We've seen people dressed up as Megan on red carpets doing her, you know, tantalizing, weird, off-kilter dancing. But ain't nothing wrong with a conventional horror movie with a funny doll, because her reaction shots in the movie are why you should go see this movie.
I think that is maybe the most underrated thing about the film. Cutting to Megan reacting to anything
dinner.
Someone is saying is, it's so fucking funny, and it never got old.
No, literally, her eyes would just shoot left and right, you know, like a character in a Poirot mystery. And it was funny every time. I would actually compare it to last summer when we had Isabelle Huppert on. She was promoting a movie called Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris with Leslie Manville. And the thrill of that movie is there's like, you know, lovely dresses in the movie. It's a fashion-centric movie. And you get to see Leslie Manville reacting with delight and awe to everything. And Megan is the same way. These things unfold, except it's a horror movie. And then you get to see Megan, who is raising an eyebrow or looking to the right or, you know, furtively planning a murder. And you all see it on her face.
And I think what's actually a highlight of this, as opposed to Child's Play, which, you know, this movie isn't Child's Play, by the way. Child's Play is a masterpiece of the genre. And also is much gorier. The one disappointing thing I will say about Megan is it's PG-13. So we don't get as much as the gore, as much of the gore as I felt like we deserved. But what's beautiful about this film is that she is a talking doll who's sort of like AI. So you get to interact with Megan early on, as opposed to waiting for, is this doll going to start talking and be creepy? You're sort of in on it from the beginning, and everything that bitch says is funny. I mean, it was in the trailer when she says, you know, like the line, I thought we were having a conversation, but somehow it was funnier in the movie where, I don't know where this fucking southern twang of hers comes from. She says to Allison Williams at one point, she's like, now hold up, I thought we were having a conversation. And it's just so funny hearing Megan say anything.
Also, the word conversation just in general is funny. It's very Ayanla. Or, you know. Also, I think as it's going along, I think the movie is well made. Like, you're not watching it thinking, oh, this is an amateur production or it's entirely kitschy. I wouldn't call it extremely scary either. And the ending of the movie in particular is like a bit anticlimactic. But it really is note for note, basically The Boy Next Door. If you remember that Jennifer Lopez movie where the whole premise is, this thing, in this case a man, is obsessed with you. And so he's going to do all he can to protect you. And oh, now he's in the your backyard. Now he's over there. Now he's killing Kristen Chenoweth or whatever's going on. It's the same feeling of that, except you get funny doll reaction shots. I literally would say there is no difference between those two movies. So in a way, the problem with Megan, and also why it's watchable, is that it's extremely conventional for a horror movie of this type.
I will say, though, that Megan does not give me the same feelings that Ryan Guzman does.
Oh, God. By the way, what did we do with him? I know he was in Everybody
Step
Wants
Up.
Him. Step Up. Can you believe it? I'm not entirely versed in those films.
But I miss him, actually. He was like one of our hotter, you know, sort of generic actors who's in a Step Up movie, can sort of dance, does a couple other things. And yeah, then I guess sort of vanished.
He was shockingly, I mean, extremely, extremely attractive. I don't mean to play down the Step Up movies. As you know, at the Actors Studio, I studied under Professor DeJuan Tatum.
Actually, I found out where he is, where so many of our actors go to die. He's on the Ryan Murphy series, 911.
Oh, I was going to say, is it a streaming series I've never heard of? But that's always a possibility. I've brought up this theory before. You think of some actor you're obsessed with, and you're like, God, it's been 3 years. What happened? It's like, I'll tell you what happened. The Stars Network. They're doing a long time show there.
When I look at the cast of 911, first of all, Angela Bassett.
She's still on it. It's a Mike and Molly situation. Yeah.
I don't know what deal she signed with Ryan Murphy, the devil, but she needs to be freed.
God, it's really crazy that show is still on.
Peter Krause. Jennifer Love Hewitt.
Jennifer Love Hewitt, one of those people who I believe never stopped working. If you piece it all together, it's like, how long was she whispering ghosts? Was it 18 years? Maybe.
Which actually tells you that Jennifer Love Hewitt loves acting and working.
Yes.
Because, or she has a lot of gambling debts. I don't know. Because the Ghost Whisperer, Party of Five, Time of Your Life. She has been syndicated. I mean, the Ghost Whisperer alone must be like paying for every house she owns.
Right. Well, also, something about Jennifer Love Hewitt, my suspicion is that she's great to work with. And this is what this is based on. I'm being a detective now. She is one of the few very memorable episodes of MTV's Diary, where her best friend on that show was literally a fan she met. I feel like that means you're down to earth and not a crazy person. Like, I'm not saying go and befriend the person who runs up to you on the street. Absolutely not saying that at all. But if you're just like, well, whatever, she's a cool person, why not hang out? Maybe you're down to earth. I don't know. Feel free to DM me theories about that.
That sounds like a thriller, like The Roommate or something.
Yeah, I basically just told you what Ingrid Goes West is. I don't mean for it to sound like that, but she was just like cool beans about everything.
Yeah, I mean, listen, has anyone from the cast of Kids Incorporated not turned out to be amazing?
I know. I mean, I can only think of Fergie right now, but great. Yeah. Oh wait,
Eric Balfour.
Right, of course.
Yeah, Fergie was in Kids Incorporated.
Yes.
And two other people, Mario Lopez and I Love Your Smile, Shanice.
I fucking love that song. If I'm at CVS and that comes on, I'm in the splits and I'm laughing and I'm singing. She was also it in that video too, giving you like that full like 45 tooth Mentadent grin.
Yeah, I miss Shanice. Come back to us.
Great song.
Yeah.
I think it was sampled recently somewhat in something. I forget what.
I feel like Shanice could very well come back to us because Everything But The Girl is releasing a new album. Like their first did you miss this? Their first in 23 years.
Oh my God. What about Deep Blue Something? I'm a defender of the song Breakfast at Tiffany's, more so than I am the movie Breakfast at Tiffany's.
So Shanice, now's your time. I want to know what you think about his smile now.
Has it changed? Yeah. Has Invisalign affected the conversation?
So anyway, Megan is fun. I would highly recommend seeing it in a theater because, you know.
You must see it with 11 people. See it with 11 people.
Okay, now we can get to the awards movies. And I would say if we were doing our own version of, you know, the Keep It Awards, what are your best pictures that you've seen?
Okay, well, we've discussed Tar already. I think Tar is still my number one in terms of a movie that leaves you with questions in a really good way, really intentionally. There's so much that's mysterious and surreal about the movie, but it's all in the service of getting in this main character's head. And she is just among the kind of deepest and hairiest characters we've had on screen in like 10 years. So I have to say it's my number one. I did enjoy After Sun, which have we talked about that?
We have Paul not. Mescal. I have not seen it yet, but I am quite familiar with Paul Mescal and his legs.
Yes, right. And they're not normal people legs. You know what I'm saying?
Now, two things about Paul Mescal. One, he's going to be in Merrily We Roll Along, which is not a great Sondheim musical, and I kind of wish it would die, but I'm here for him singing.
Yeah. And also, he's taking over the role of Blake Jenner, just to bring this back to Everybody Wants Some. But he has spent 20 years filming this. This is that movie with Beanie Feldstein that's supposed to take 175 years before we get just the right musical we need.
Yeah, Richard Linklater. You know? I think my friend Juan said something about Richard is going to die in the editing booth.
Right. I mean, he has no choice. These projects seem like labors of Hercules. It makes no sense.
The other thing about Paul is that he has been spending a lot of time with Angelina Jolie.
Right, which, of course, you and I are going to support. Apparently, Phoebe Bridgers is now out of the picture. Maybe. But he is an awesome actor. Also, it's interesting. He's like sort of a fringe for the best actor conversation this year. And it's because this is a movie that is not in your face. It's a very unassuming film in certain ways. It's an emotional movie that draws you in. And it's also a movie where you're piecing it together and it's only at the very end when you're sort of clear on why you just saw the sequence of events that you saw. And it's tender and tough in a way. But man, he is just great. The kind of actor who doesn't look like they're trying at all, even though they're doing so much. He's like sort of the quintessential 2023 actor right now. Like awesome, just sense of normalcy and reality about him, and it draws you in, and it doesn't feel contrived in any way. I don't know. He's just really great.
Yeah, I'm a big Paul Mescal fan, and I'm also looking forward to him being in Gladiator, the sequel.
Don't think I've wrapped my head around the fact that we're getting a Gladiator sequel. That whole era of movies feels very dead to me. It's like if we got a sequel to Iris or something. Jim Broadbent, come back to us.
Yeah. I would say that one of my faves this year is, and I know that you didn't love this as much as I did, if only from your tweets, but Banshees of Inisherin.
I enjoy it. It felt like an elongated short story to me. Like we could have handled it in 45 minutes. But the thing where I differ from the conversation is that I do think Colin Farrell's really good at it. I think he's better in After Yang. And I also think the two other main characters in it outshine him in the movie, which are Brendan Gleeson, who weirdly has never been nominated for an Oscar, playing a curmudgeonly man who in this Irish town in the, I think the 1920s, basically, this isn't giving anything away. It's in the first part of the movie. He's just sick of hanging out with Colin Farrell. He's sick of seeing him. And it begins with him saying, I don't want to see you anymore. And they're just friends. And now they're not. Then Colin Farrell's sister in the movie is played by an actress named Carrie Condon. And I kind of can't explain what this woman does. I can't explain how she does it. There's not one part of her what she has to do on screen that's like weird or demanding, and yet it's so full of life and so enchanting. And if this movie didn't have her, it would be a completely different movie. She's excellent. Wouldn't mind if she won Best Supporting Actress this year.
I think that's actually why I love Martin McDonagh, and I've always loved him, and I've forgiven him for Three Billboards now.
I was going to say, I do think that is one of my disappointments of the decade, Three Billboards.
Yes. But I think it comes from him being a playwright too, you know? It's just that character in any other sort of like writer's hands would just be like Colin Farrell's sister, and she's just sort of there to like say a couple sassy things and then leave. But there is so much to her character from even the short amount of scenes that she's in. It's just like a complete arc and a complete sense of like longing and a complete sense of how she fits into this community and how she fits into these people's lives. You know, even like from interactions with other people at the pub, like how they react to her, like it shows like how well they know her. I just think it's a really beautiful film. I do agree that it's sort of, he's sort of like taking his time with the film, like it's longer than it needs to be. But I will also say that, you know, like I never really mind hanging out in the worlds that he creates.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to spend too much time any one place, it better be, you know, idyllic Ireland, you know, it better be. Yeah. Look, it better look like an illustration on a box of pastels, which is what this universe is.
And Barry Keoghan was fantastic.
As always, he comes on screen and just like, your body folds in on itself because you're like, this man is capable of too much creepiness. What am I about to get into? That fucking movie, Killing of a Sacred Deer, it hasn't left me.
Yes, that, and he really stole Cillian Murphy's game, didn't he?
You're right. Every once in a while, it does feel like you can see when one actor takes over where another one was. And I always say this in regards to Michael Shannon taking over the Christoph Waltz spot. It feels like we just stopped one, began another.
What else did you love this year?
Okay, well, this is very borderline in the awards conversation. In fact, it's not even fair to say that. It's out of the conversation. But guys, I thought I Want to Dance with Somebody was good.
I did too. I am, first of all, the entire movie is Naomi Ackie. She was
great.
Phenomenal.
Yes. Why are people talking about her? That she absolutely summoned Whitney Houston, and we gave her the hardest parts to do, which is recreate this concert footage. Now, I'm not saying every time I watch a biopic, I want to see, you know, millisecond by millisecond recreations of famous moments in this person's life, but she really brought them out. I was watching, you know, that AMA's performance she slayed, that the Super Bowl, one by one, you really... The Whitney Houston moments lined up and they were believable. I loved her dynamic with the actors who played Robin, who was also amazing.
Yes. Her wigs, criminal. Her suits,
but they were at the time.
Awful.
Yes.
But she's, yeah, she's like a fucking star. She was lip syncing for her life. Okay.
Yes.
Like, congratulations. Like, she's the winner of this challenge. Like, I would love for Naomi to be nominated. I think she's fantastic in the film. I think that, you know, she, it's an example of her really sort of carrying the film. This is another outing from Casey Lemons. And, you know, we've had Casey on Keep It. And I think she's so smart. And obviously, she directed one of our favorite films, Eve's Bayou. But
yes, the official film of Keep It. Yes.
But I will say, she still has not directed anything like Eve's Bayou since, you know? Because this movie was giving pedestrian.
Well, I mean, like, Eve's Bayou is in its own sort of, like, haunted spiritual realm. And this is very much in the mold of a movie like, I'm sorry to say it, Bohemian Rhapsody. But yeah. I would say it's better than Bohemian Rhapsody in that, yes, it's a Wikipedia of events, but it's so tasteful in what it decides to get into. For instance, I think Casey Lemons or whoever made this choice made the right choice by saying the most fascinating thing about Whitney Houston is her relationship with Clive Davis. You know,
yes.
What they had to go to through for her to get to that height, what they navigated once it started to fall apart. And you get, in a way, the prototype Stanley Tucci performance, which is...
He's so tender in this movie.
Yes. He's, you know, he's giving you effete Stanley Tucci, who, you know, is supporting the female hero and lightly critical of her at all times. We've seen that a few times before. And I am also referring to Burlesque. They really get into...
One of his best roles.
Yes, please. They really get into the intricacies of what it took for him to kind of guide her back onto the rails, how she would push back on him. That, to me, is a very interesting dynamic and something we don't see in a lot of movies. And it elevated the film for me.
It's interesting that you brought up Bohemian Rhapsody because, of course, Anthony McCarten wrote Bohemian Rhapsody and this film. And
yes.
I would call him one of her hardest working hacks in the business.
You can be a good hack.
Okay, so let me, because like Theory of Everything, Darkest right, Hour.
Wow, two Popes, right down the line. Right down the line. Yeah.
And unfortunately, one of the worst plays I have ever seen, The Collaboration.
Oh, who's in it?
Jeremy Pope and Paul Bettany. It's on Broadway now. It's about Warhol and Basquiat. And it is also just like Wikipedia pages talking to each other.
Oh, no. I mean, that's, you can expect some of that when you look at this. I call these movies Trumbos. Remember the movie Trumbo? It's like that. Also, if you remember the movie Trumbo, you might only be me.
But this is, I don't know, it's one of my things about biopics. And I feel like at least this had a point of view with the Robin relationship and the Clive relationship. But I will say that, like, it's my problem with, like, The Collaboration and, like, you know, Theory of Everything and things like this. It's like, there's really no point of view, especially Bohemian Rhapsody. There's no point of view. There's no, what do you have to say about this person? It's just, no, here's this person's life and some bullet points. It's like, but you haven't said anything. I don't know why you as an artist were drawn to this.
And also, because of that, the movie then feels extremely safe too. You know, like, I would compare Bohemian Rhapsody to the movie J. Edgar, where it, like, walks up to wondering what was really going on with J. Edgar and the cross-dressing, but then sort of averts its glance and then walks another direction and doesn't really say anything. Like, Bohemian Rhapsody had some explicit indication of, like, oh, he's gay and, like, here's what was going on in his life, but it also just felt like the other band members were responsible for making it a very anesthetized film, ultimately. Yeah.
Unfortunately, The Collaboration is also being filmed. So...
Wow, you lose again.
When we're back, more of what we've been watching on our break. And we're back with more movies chat.
Should we talk about Babylon now?
Yeah.
Guys, I swear I'm a more critical seeming person than this. I don't want to lose credibility with everybody. Guys, I thought it was good. The first hour, this movie throws itself at you, says, look, we are just going to be Hollywood cum dump disgusting zoo. It's going to be revolting at every turn. Every frame of this movie for the first 2 hours looks like...
From the first frame.
Yes.
An elephant shitting on someone is how we start this movie. And I was like, you know what? I'm in.
May as well. Right. But it's like every frame of this movie looks like a Where's Waldo image. There's just 20,000 people there. They're all doing something different. You know, tubas flying in different directions, saxophones, whatever. And then you get the performances, which I think are good. Even Margot Robbie, who I feel like will be left out of the Best Actress conversation this year. But I will say, and this was a question we had when we saw the previews, why is she styled like 1980s Madonna? Why couldn't they have just made her seem like an authentic late 20s person? It like is completely sticking in your head as you're watching this film, and she's speaking like somebody who could not have existed until the 80s.
Her jazzy accent.
Yeah, right. She's from New Jersey, right?
Is she? I don't remember where she's from. There's a lot going on in the movie, okay?
Yeah.
And I also loved it. But I will also say Damien Chazelle needs to be in prison.
It's definitely too fucking long. And also, you know what movie I would compare it to? The Wolf of Wall Street, speaking of Margot Robbie. The first 2 hours are just full of like, I'll say it kind of machismo-laden whiz bang. You know, it's like fast and gross and profane. And then in the last hour, they try a couple of weird warped turns. One of them I like. And then the other one, which is basically the coda of the movie that becomes into a big We Love Movie Making montage.
It's a fan cam.
Yeah, it's a fan cam. It's not a montage.
It is a fan cam. And I'm always like not a fan of films about the pictures where it sort of ends with someone just sobbing as they're in a movie theater. I'm like, okay. Are you just supposed
right,
to
we're there now. We're in the theater now. We're already here. Yeah.
You're supposed to be making me sob.
Right.
You know, I thought that, you know, first of all, I'm happy that he made the film that he wanted to make. I feel like I like La La Land better than this film. But, you know, it's a testament to just, you know, like an artist making a film that they really want to make. And I respect this film a lot.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, he made the film he wanted to make. It's what he has to say about film. The ending's a bit trite, but, you know, I just feel like overall, I love the excess of the film. This truly does not stop. You know, like there's a scene towards the end between Jean Smart and Brad Pitt where things sort of finally stop and people are really having a conversation with one another. And it was nice to breathe. You know, it wasn't so tense. It wasn't all this shit happening. And I felt like that was great. Like one of my favorite scenes in the film, I thought Jean Smart was fantastic. Brad, I didn't really give a fuck about in this film.
Interesting thing about Brad in this movie. I think one of the things holding this movie back is that it's a character, one, he's played before, and two, could play in his sleep. Just in a way, it felt like you were watching a continuation of some other performance you've already seen of his. I did like that scene with him and Jean Smart, though I think she gives one of the least impressive performances in this movie. And maybe I've had it a little bit with representations of Hedda Hopper types. Like, you know, grizzled, snappy woman who walks into the room with a feather that's 11 feet tall pointing out of a hat. Speaking of Trumbo and Helen Mirren therein. But this movie, I think, has one of the great shooting a movie scenes ever, which is Margot Robbie taking take after take to do this one thing. And she's also having to contend with how new sound is in movies. So the LOL stress the crew is going through to deal with it is very inventive. I thought that was an awesome scene in the movie.
Speaking of like a Hedda Hopper type, you know, Tilda Swinton and Hail Caesar, which I actually think is a more successfully made film than Babylon. I think Hail Caesar is incredibly underrated. I loved that film so much. And I think George Clooney would have probably brought, like George Clooney, I think would have had that necessary sort of like depth that you needed for this role that Brad didn't really bring to it, you know? And I say this as a former fan of Brad Pitt. as we know, I'm Team Angelina Jolie. But it wasn't one of my favorite Brad performances. I loved Lee Joon Lee in the film, but once again,
yes,
Damien Chazelle underserves every character who's not white.
Yes, I will say about George Clooney, I think he would have been a more interesting choice for the role because it would have been a sleazier role for George Clooney, which we don't really get from him. Whereas I think Brad is too accustomed to sleaze at this point. Like it's less novel. It's less interesting to see him have to do the kind of a grisly, aged out actor things he does in this movie.
Mm-hmm. No, but Lee Joon Lee plays this fantastic character in the film who's just sort of
kind of an anime Wong. Yeah.
Yeah. But she's sort of like written out like halfway through the film, you know, and then reappears. And it's just like, she was one of the most interesting characters in the film to me. And it was sad to see her drop out. And I'm just going to say this now. I need this man to stop writing about jazz.
you know, we have had it. And I want to say we voiced our concerns at the time. We voiced our concerns at the time, too.
Yeah. And listen, I had like minor criticisms of the jazz storyline in La La Land, and then somehow became the face of hating La La Land. But this, I really did enjoy this movie. But I want to say, the jazz storyline, you know, it disappointed me. Mostly because you have this black character who's a jazz singer, you know, and then, you know, like there's the advent of blackface and Al Jolson and all that going on. But it's just sort of everything that he was saying about Hollywood and like, you know, like the things that people will do to make it in Hollywood, you know, like the drive that's there. It didn't really jive with this story that he was telling because, you know, I mean, it's just sort of like, oh, well, the black person's gonna, you know, realize the real art is doing jazz with other black people. I was just, I didn't get where it was going. And it felt so removed from the rest of the movie.
I will say that because this movie has its own disgusting point of view, it has more value than what I'm about to say. But this movie is the most expensive Ryan Murphy's Hollywood of all time, too. You have to know you're getting that. This, like, I'm gonna lightly rewrite Hollywood history to say, what if this happened or this happened and this person ended up here and this, you know, like this anime Wong type had this other kind of arc and was friendly with the Brad Pitt type legends. And as you remember, that didn't do anything for us ultimately once upon a time. But I think this movie is better than that.
I also just say that like with those characters zipping around each other so much in the film, there's never really a moment where they are with one another. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. it doesn't seem like the relationships have a lot of weight, which ultimately is why I feel like the main romance of the film doesn't really work for me.
Yeah, the main relationship in the movie, which is Margot Robbie, this burgeoning star, and Diego Calva, who plays this guy who basically walks onto a set hoping to get a job, and what happens to their characters throughout the movie. They sort of intertwine, they're sort of good friends, and then they need each other at random moments. But yeah, it's sort of a sparse relationship.
Yeah. Anyway, I really enjoyed this movie. And I would say that a counterpart to it is The Fabelmans, which
another
is sort
we
of
love
also,
movies movie. Yes.
Yeah. Which, you know, Spielberg loves a We Loves Movies movie. And surprise, surprise, I loved it because you know what? Spielberg's good at what he fucking does.
I like the sentimentality of how this young character, this boy, who I guess is Steven Spielberg, comes into being a filmmaker. And I liked, and Spielberg always does this well, how the kid has a clear but very small window into adult problems. Like they capture that well. Like I'm reading what's happening to my kind of kooky artist mom, and what's happening to her relationship with my dad and this other guy who's in the picture, and I'm figuring out what it all means to me. But I have to say, I think the movie falls apart because you need to just be invested in the fact that this is what created Spielberg. Like, that has to be the thrust of the drama for you. Otherwise, it just sort of felt like, yeah, this kid's growing up in the suburbs and sometimes life sucks a little bit. I don't know. It felt like it was very low stakes for me. And also, among Michelle Williams' performances, somebody else said this, and I can't remember who. I apologize. They said something about Michelle Williams' acting that rings true to me, which is she's a brilliant scene partner. When somebody's being like a dick to her, she like knows how to emotionally respond to that really well, or like be in a great two-person scene. Think of her at the sink in Brokeback Mountain, or when she has that confrontation with Casey Affleck at the end of Manchester by the Sea. But here, I think she's supposed to be playing an odd bohemian artist type who happens to end up being a somewhat conventional suburban mom. And to me, Michelle Williams has no natural eccentricity about her. So her choices to make this character feel real don't amount to much more than sometimes she's happy and sometimes she's sad. I'm really surprised this is what people think is her big Oscars moment, because to me, she does not have a fucking prayer against Michelle Yeoh or Cate Blanchett or Danielle Deadwyler in Till. Like, all three of them have her outclassed fully.
She should have stayed in supporting, to be honest. Yeah. And I feel like I was discussing this with a friend as well, because I've just recently, over the break, and we'll get into this, but I've been catching up on like a bunch of Cassavetes films.
Sure. You know?
And I finally
I love a good uncomfortable viewing.
Well, I finally saw Opening Night for the first time, and you know, oh, like a Jenna Rollins like sort of fucking masterpiece. But that is what Michelle was giving. She starts the movie at a 15.
Yeah.
And I feel like, unfortunately, like Spielberg has to catch up with her performance.
Yes, yes.
You know, she's what you said about like her being a great scene partner, but doing stuff on her own is sort of just not working in the film. And I think that's it. Like, she just, the movie starts and like Michelle is just doing a lot, you know, and eventually she comes down to earth with the relationship with Seth Rogen and the disintegration of her marriage with Paul Dano. And then, of course, you know, her relationship with her son. I will also say that Gabriel LaBella is fantastic in this film. And I'm like really looking forward to what else he's going to do after this.
Yeah, it's a hefty role. I mean, he's playing, you know, our eyes into the movie and also a kid. And I just in general, I think in the past 10 years, kid actors have just really improved and dropped what our general feelings about precociousness. I feel like those are going away a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
Not everyone has that sort of Ian Armitage sheen over them.
Well, he's also 20.
All right, he's an adult, functioning male.
But, I mean, Spielberg's also just still good at finding, like, young talent, you know?
Right. Oh, my God. If you haven't seen the footage of Henry Thomas trying out for E.T., and you can hear, and he does this incredible tear-strewn thing to get into the movie, Spielberg's response to him is just unbelievable. He's like, okay, kid, you've got the part. Like, almost afraid of him. It's really fun. But I will say something I liked about this movie. So Tony Kushner is the screenwriter on it. It gets into an anti-Semitism storyline, which I think is great and adds real depth to the movie. But then there's this whole segment where he's bullied at school and he shows up the bully by creating a film that has him in it. The bully's response to that, which is heated and strange, makes no sense to me. And my guess is it really happened to Spielberg in real life, and he tried to get it on the page and into the movie because he felt it was such an unusual experience. But as a piece of story in this film, it does not work for me. And it's not emotional, and it's just strange.
I would posit that maybe some of that happened to Spielberg. Maybe some of it happened with Kushner. Mm. If only because that scene felt like a gay coming of age film. And there was a scene where I thought that this boy, the bully in school, was going to kiss him.
Yes, right. Like, oh, you've seen through my rage, and guess what's underneath?
A tender I'm a faggot.
Homosexual. Yes. I'm a faggot, he screamed.
But that's where it seemed like it was going. And I think that would have been an interesting story. And I also now think that I need, like, Spielberg has done every, like, coming-of-age film. You know, I think we need a gay one.
You're right. And actually, I'm upset.
Yeah. And I think with Tony working with him, like, I love their partnership from Lincoln to this and West Side Story. Mm-hmm. I think that I would love to see what he'd do with that. You know, I mean, listen, I wouldn't want many straight male directors like tackling like a gay coming of age story, but let me tell you, like, Spielberg's second best film, in my opinion, is The Color Purple. So, you know, and you couldn't tell me a white man directed that film. So, but you know, he's also Jewish, you know, so it makes sense. And I would agree with what you said about the film not it doesn't really go over it doesn't really reach that point where I'm like, this is like a best picture. And it's not even in the best, like in the top 10 of Spielberg's films. But do think it's just always nice watching a film of his because he knows what he's doing. And it's always nice to know that like you're in the hands of a director who's going to tell you a story that's going to move you. I was moved. Yeah. Whether or not
it feels all professionally completely
works.
Done. Yeah.
But I just also think his filmmaking in this film is great. I mean, talking about Babylon, the scene, you know, with Margot Robbie and the tears, I felt like a lot of the sequences where Sam Fableman is making films were my favorite parts of the film.
Yes, I agree. He really captured something there. I'm sorry, my mind is still blown about how he really should have a gay protagonist because Spielberg is so obsessed with both the whimsy and the sad, lonely heft of childhood. And how better to realize both those things than to get into a character coming out? Anyway, he should do that.
Yeah, let me tell you something. Being gay in childhood is a sad, lonely heft.
Thank you for that one-page monologue that I read when I'm trying out for the fall play. Thank you.
Any other performances that you really loved this year?
Performance. I brought up Daniel Deadweiler in Till, which I finally saw. Now
she's so fucking good.
Jesus Christ. First of all, who are you? You can't just be good like that. I have to be prepared for the talent you're about to bring. When I have no like coordinates to put me on the earth you live in, I get very confused. So Daniel Deadweiler plays the mother of Emmett Till, a slain child. And as the movie begins, you know you're going to get like the trauma performance. You know you're going to get the woman being like, why did this happen? It's going to be horrible to watch. You know, hearkening back to the 30 Rock parody, hard to watch with Tracy Jordan. I did not expect what this movie really is about, which is it's a lot like the Meryl Streep movie, A Cry in the Dark, which is a movie about a woman who is being perceived constantly by the media and her steeliness and her resolve to tell a particular story about something that has happened to her and her family and represent that well and not give people sort of what they expect, basically, even if it would be in their idea, in her best interest. I was just blown away. It's such an impossible performance. It's the amount of devastation in it is like impossible to comprehend, and just what she does and how you're locked into her thinking every step of the way. I'm always so impressed when people can do that. A performance I think that is not at all like this, but reminds me of that is Saoirse Ronan in Brooklyn. That's a movie about a woman making decisions, and
you famously you don't love have women to making decisions.
That's please.
Women
Sarah
talking.
Pauly. Sarah Pauly, where's the movie Women Making Decisions? Please. Yes. A movie I liked, by the way, kind of forgot about, but I liked it. You're so locked into what's going through this woman's head. That's all I can say. It's fabulous. So fabulous is a crazy word for this movie. It is so hard to watch certain times.
That's because you don't like women talking, Lewis. You like women thinking.
Yes, right.
Silently thinking. You know, you want to see their face.
I want it to be like Garfield where we see the thought bubbles though. Yeah.
Well, listen, one thing about Mamie Till is she loves lasagna. Chinoye Chukwu is a great director. Between Clemency and this.
I did not know she did Clemency. If you are not caught up on the book of Alfre Woodard, I think she's at 178 Emmy nominations at this point.
That's a great back-to-back of films, and also two films that, you know, I mean, unless Danielle like gets a nomination for this, another film that's just sort of like under the award season radar, because like Alfre should have been nominated for Clemency.
Yeah, I mean, that's I think to me her definitive film performance. She was nominated once in the 80s, 1983, for a movie called Cross Creek, which is about the children's author Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings, played by Mary Steenburgen. But all I can say this year is Best Actress is basically the only real production we have going on for the Oscars, because the Cate Blanchett component, the Michelle Yeoh component, and the Danielle Deadweiler component, these are three very disparate performances. You can't compare them in any way. So voters have a real extreme and kind of strange decision before them. I'm really looking forward to it.
I would say I really loved this year Taylor Russell in Bones and All.
I did not love her in that movie. I thought he was great, and I thought she was not good. But I felt like she got that signed that character that day to me.
Not a student scene at DePaul. Yeah.
I tried out for DePaul. Failed, by the way. Anyway.
I liked her. I really loved Nicholas Hoult in The Menu.
But Nicholas Hoult, I did not know he had that level of douchebag in him. This is not my opinion.
Are you not watching The Great?
I guess not. Oh, nope, I've never seen it. So you're right. I'm missing something.
He is so
I loved him in The Favorite. Yeah,
funny in that. He's so funny. And he plays like a dumb asshole douchebag in The Great too, which is like really fantastic. And
I did not care for The Menu other than Ralph Fiennes is one of my favorite actors. But I will say, Janet McTeer slayed it. Loved her as that character, as like the sort of pretentious restaurateur.
Yeah, she was really good. I liked The Menu, and it sort of reminded me a bit of, I saw it right after Glass Onion. And I would say that, you know, like Glass Onion as an ensemble piece gave the characters like a lot to do because, you know, like it's a murder mystery. And I would say like that was sort of one of the downfalls of The Menu. You sort of got brief flashes of who these characters were, you know, just to move the story along. But I don't really think ultimately you learned anything about these characters. And like the ending feels like completely false to me.
I think the problem with The Menu is it feels like a Twilight Zone episode to me, where the twist where you learn what's really good going on should be the end of the movie. And then unfortunately it goes on for another hour where you're already like locked into the twist and sort of ambivalent about what occurs afterwards. Glass Onion, which maybe we talked about before, but quickly I will just say, I've seen it twice, loved it, watched it with my family, good family viewing. I do think the movie has a slight problem where it goes from setting up the mystery to explaining the mystery. There's very little time in between where you're actually in the mystery. That said, everybody is well cast, and it was nice to see Ed Norton playing, you know, a rich D-bag.
Yeah, the mystery element of it was lesser than in Knives Out, and I think that Knives Out edges out Glass Onion, you know, as my favorite. But I really had a good fucking time watching Glass Onion in theaters, which I hunted down to watch in Milan. Because I was like, I want to see this movie in fucking theaters. Lastly, my favorite movie of the year was Triangle of Sadness.
Oh, what a trip. The movie should be called What a Trip.
That's every Ostlund film, though. Like The Square, Force Majeure. It's like you go in with like a concept of what the film's about to be, and then an hour in, because these films are always long, an hour in, you're like, oh no, wait, this is a completely different fucking film.
Yes. There are two giant twists. The middle section of the movie I like best. I don't know that I love this is kind of spoilery, survivor portion of the movie, even though Dolly De Leon is really good. And I also, the final beat where they stumble upon a luxury hotel, very funny. I did think that was very funny.
Well, one of the best needle drops of the year. Hearing that Fred again song, and you're just like, what the fuck is happening? And then all of a sudden, oh! Beautiful. And I would say that, I'm going to bring it back to what I was saying about Cassavetes. I was reading like an interview with him too, of just about how he works with his actors. And it's why I sort of like his, you know, like he had his own acting like style, you know, too. His thing was really about like letting people create their own characters and like just staying in a scene too long because you would let the actors really sort of interact with each other. And I think what Triangle of Sadness does very well is Austin will just sort of like I think of like the opening where they're arguing over the check, or I think about The Square with Elizabeth Moss and the condom. Like it really just takes scenes and like lets actors just sort of like be their character and have fun.
Yeah, it's not rushed. Correct. Yes.
Yeah. Also, okay, Anna's in the waiting room. Let me just say this guy's name. Also, Harry Dickinson is so fucking hot.
Oh, Harris Dickinson, please. You think I didn't watch Beach Rats? Like, I barely could even look at him. It was like looking at the sun. I was like, some people are so hot, you're embarrassed you have to see them. Like, it's just like, oh God, like, why do I have to be a human being in your presence? It's so tough.
You know what I would say that he is? He's sleazy Paul Mescal.
Which we need. Paul Mescal, a little cleaned up for me.
Yeah, you know what? If there's like a Sweet Valley High reboot with like them as men and they're adults, Harris Dickinson, Paul Mescal.
that proposition that everyone's constantly making. Thank you for finally verbalizing it. Yeah.
Call me up, Zaslav. I'm ready to make it for HBO Discovery. Max, whatever the fuck it's called.
Yeah, right.
All right, coming up, we are joined by Anna Kendrick.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across six southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th, watch Long Play series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You know our first guest of 2023 from Pitch Perfect, Into the Woods, Love Life, 100 Other Things, and now you can catch her in Alice Darling, which drops exclusively in AMC theaters on January 20th. Welcome to Keep It, the delightful Emmy, Tony, and Academy Award nominated Anna Kendrick.
Oh my goodness, that felt very sincere. You're very good at this.
Years of practice. The authenticity is merely a veneer.
5 minutes ago, he was like trash.
You know what's interesting? It's crazy that you have all those award nominations. You seem like a regular actress, you know, but you're in this Viola Davis category with all these fucking nominations.
Thank you for calling me someone who seems just like some regular actress, first of all. I'm just gonna take everything you say and twist it. That's gonna be my game the whole recording. Yeah. Because I had been nominated for a Tony, an Oscar, and a Grammy, and I'd lost all of those. And then I got nominated for an Emmy, and I was like, I kind of hope that I lose because then I get to say like I'm an EGOT loser.
Which, if I'm not mistaken, I think is kind of funny. No, if I'm not mistaken, Lynn Redgrave is for the longest time was the only person to be nominated for all four and not win any of them. So you would be joining very slim ranks.
That's surprising because certainly it seems like there would be a lot more EGOT losers than EGOT winners.
Right.
But you're saying that usually along the way, someone wins something, but not Anna.
You defied the odds in a way. I can't explain it.
I'm a trailblazer. Yeah. Yeah.
To be fair, a lot of our EGOT winners are, they don't win it competitively. A lot of our EGOT winners have Tonys for producing a play.
Yep. That's fair. I need to get in there.
One of those like winners where it's like pages long. You're just like a scroll at the end of a movie. Like that's the level of winner.
Love seeing at the Tonys, like when Best Musical gets announced that, you know, it's the main team around the microphone and people just keep trickling on slowly who you're like, they don't seem, I'll bet you no one on that crew and cast knows who that person is. But they technically did something, so they get to kind of like aimlessly wander on and go, it's happening. I did it. I'm here.
It is a ton of people. Yes.
No, especially living in New York, I will see the LA party thing is you hear someone talking about like a show or a movie or whatever they're working on. You will be at a party in New York and someone will tell you that they're a producer on Mean Girls. And you're like, okay, sure.
Me too.
While we're on the topic of awards, thinking about the awards campaign for Up in the Air is a specific time for me because it was just when I moved to LA. it's an interesting season because Monique basically steamrolled that year. She
oh
was
my
like,
God.
That movie she came was, out very oh. early on. And so people were very attuned to that performance early on. But you were there every step of the way. And so, what was it fun to be a part of that conversation with a co-star, Vera Farmiga?
Yeah.
And then who else? It was Penelope Cruz and one more. Oh, Maggie Gyllenhaal, who also sometimes looks exactly like Vera Farmiga. That's how I remember.
Was it Maggie Gyllenhaal? Because I think there were... I think it was me and Monique, and I know Vera got nominated for everything, if not almost everything or whatever. And then it was kind of satellites. So I probably don't remember. You probably remember better than I do who was nominated for what. I think that there was actually something, because I saw Precious at TIFF, when Up in the Air had, you know, like premiered at TIFF, and I can't remember which one happened first, but like it was one day after the other. And I remember like watching Precious and thinking, holy shit, this is a hell of a performance. Oh my God. Oh my God. And then like the, you know, those kind of final scenes with Monique happened. And I was like, oh, well, for God's sakes, this is like a performance for the ages, you know?
Correct.
And it was like kind of a relief. Like at that point, to be very clear, at that point, the idea of being nominated for an Academy Award was not, I remember it was at TIFF that I was doing some interview with Jason Bateman. I was paired with Jason Bateman, and he made this comment about like, well, you know, she did great in the movie. And I think this spring you're going to like be picking out a really nice gown. And I remember, this is weird, but I actually remember at the time almost thinking like he was like almost being kind of mean, like teasing me or something, like in the way that if it had been a movie about swimming, he might have been like, ah, the Olympics might be calling. You know what I mean? Like, it was just so like
a light taunt. Just, yeah.
a light taunt. Exactly. And so like the idea of being nominated was like I was just getting questions about that and stuff. And it seemed so, you know, out of the realm of reality and everything. But then once it started like feeling like, oh, everybody thinks this thing is going to happen. And then it did happen. I was like, oh, it's kind of a relief to just know, like, it's a sweep for Monique. Like there's no award show where I have to be like, maybe I should have my speech ready. Or like, there's no like, oh, I won this one, but not this one. And then it also felt like me and Vera weren't competing. Like mm-hmm. It was, you know, it was kind of nice to just be like, cause it was also the year that Christoph Waltz was nominated. And
right.
It was the same thing where it was just like, it's his year. Like it was like a hell of a performance of a lifetime. And it was just like, I'm just here and I get to drink. Like, cool. Great. I don't have to do anything. I just sit here and I go, wonderful, wonderful.
I want to talk about one of your earliest performances, which is so interesting to me, remembering the film Camp, where I feel like you have Ladies Who Lunch in that. And since then, I think like you are one of the actors that I would like heavily just associate with Sondheim now, you know, because you
oh
have
my
that.
Goodness.
And then, of course, Into the Woods. Just sort of what does Sondheim as an actor, does doing Sondheim scare you? Or are you used to it now?
No, I mean, Sondheim is so difficult. And I think that even like real musicians, which are not me, would agree that Sondheim is so, so, so difficult. But it is so much fun once you get over the hurdle of like, I'm never going to crack this. Because it is like getting a little line reading from a genius. And you have freedom to... whatever, you know, explore and make discovery within that. But he's really telling you, here's your intonation, build from that how you want to. But, you know, there's not like a kind of a sweeping melody where you have like all this room to backphrase and interpret and whatever. It's like, you know, he's given you this this framework and it's very hyper specific, but and you have enough creative freedom within it, but it's, you know, it's like so fun and so challenging. I feel like I'm being annoying, but it's, yeah, I love Sondheim so much. And I will also say that he was in Camp and he showed up and he saw some like a rough cut of Ladies Who Lunch on the day that he was on set and doing his cameo. And it was like, what did he say? And he apparently said, "She has the most perfect teeth I've ever seen." And, you know, as compliments go, I'll take it. It was like, I was over the moon that it wasn't just like, you're butchering this song or whatever. And then when I did a little night music at New York City Opera when I was 17, I was so intimidated by the cast, especially, of course, when you're 17, you're like especially hoping to impress the cast members who are like mid-20s. And the first day of rehearsal, I think he was there and he like walked over and was like, "Anna, nice to see you again," and just walked away. And I was like, the 20-year-old saw that happen. Oh my God, I'm the coolest. This is amazing. This is so great. Yeah. And then obviously on Into the Woods, it was like, I had like this extra excuse to be, I mean, I'm really being generous with the phrase, like work with him, because he was updating the lyrics, for Cinderella's song for Steps of the Palace to be in present tense. So he would just kind of come in and make little tweaks when it wasn't feeling right and like make tiny little changes. And so it felt like, ah, yes, we are collaborating. This is wonderful.
So we've spoken about camp, another movie that I feel like brought you a different kind of fandom. And I want to talk about the specific fandom devoted to you and the very disparate demographics it's comprised over the years. But A Simple Favor.
Exactly.
When that movie came out, it felt film. Like it felt like people kind of expected to like it. And then it's like it took over a specific sect of Twitter. Like, it's the movie they could not get off their minds. And there were lots of parts of it. You know, it was like the whiz bang of the movie. It was, you know, what Blake Lively was wearing. It was the craziness of the movie. Did you have any idea it would really catch on? I'm trying to even think of another movie I would compare it to that it like sort of electrified that demographic in a way. I don't know, like Hustlers or something. I'm not even sure.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. I wasn't sure if you were talking about demographic or not, but I would have a hard time trying to figure out a movie to compare A Simple Favor to,
right.
Just as a movie, which was challenging for me and for Blake. Like on set, we were always looking at each other like, what movie are you in today? I'm not like, I never know. Cause it's really fucking wild to be like, it is a comedy and it's really glossy. Like we are, you know, I'm dressed crazy. She's dressed beautifully. The look of the film has a certain feeling that's, you know, very slick and very glossy. And yet I'm talking about voluntary incest and there's murder and intrigue and like, yeah. And all of those things are just sort of baked in. And like how we were just like, I don't know how this is going to get pulled off. And we were always like with comedy, it feels like you're on this like sliding scale of very subtle to very broad. And you're, you know, maybe doing options, different takes of like, where am I on the slider? And with A Simple Favor, I remember saying to Blake, it feels like the button just like came off. And now I'm just holding it and I don't know where to put it. And like, what do I can just move it in 3D space. Like, what the fuck are we doing? Which again was really exciting and really strange and scary. And I think it really wasn't until we saw the movie that it made sense to us.
Yeah, and I assume it's a movie where you had to just trust that the tone was being taken care of. You're just like, well, I'm going to do my thing. And then, you know, well, maybe it'll come together.
Yes. No. And I think obviously Paul's track record speaks for itself, but it was not, you know, he's known for Bridesmaids in a very different kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's, yeah, I think it's exciting to be a part of something where someone's doing a thing they're not known for. But yeah, also just going like, I don't have like a reference point. I don't have anything to hold on to. And I felt really grateful to have Blake as a scene partner because it felt very comfortable. You know, she's such a pro and it was just easy to go like, how about this one? We'll just do this. You know, it was just very simple and like straightforward. And we were just kind of like down to do options and try things. And like, we weren't really getting caught up in like touchy feely stuff. It was more just like, let's try this option and this option. Just try to get Paul what he wants. Cause we haven't figured it out yet, but we're just hoping he has a master plan, which he did.
You know, the way Lewis talks about that film sort of like electrifying people in a weird way, I would say sort of that's a film that I always introduce to people if they haven't seen it the same way I introduce Down with Love to people. I'm always like, this is a very funny film that you might not think is for you, but once someone starts watching it, they're like, Oh, no, I love this film.
Yes, yes. Down with Love is actually a weirdly good example. No incest in Down with Love, sadly. But yeah, that's what I always felt that film was missing. Yeah, I love that as a reference because it is like, wait, where are we? What world are we in right now?
Speaking of music, what we were talking about before, I find it so interesting that, like, I mean, you basically had the pop girl shaking with Cups. You know, like, was that so weird for you to do? Like, you're doing the movie Pitch Perfect, and like, cool, okay, like, I'm singing the song in it. But then the song becomes a phenomenon, and it's, like, basically, like, ruling Billboard.
It was so weird. I was in New York filming the last 5 years when it was, again, so weird to say, like, climbing the charts. And I was taking a nap in the basement of a church in Harlem where, like, it was the lunch break of whatever we were filming. And I remember, like, getting an update that it was, like, number 6 in the Billboard top 10 and really looking at it and going, like, I don't, you know, I think it was, like, Miley Cyrus and, like, Macklemore and whatever, I don't know, whatever else was popular at the time. And really just thinking, like, these people are, like, going on GMA and MTV and, like, promoting this single. And I'm just sitting here quietly in this basement and, like, it's just happening. What is going on? Like, why is this happening? And it did occur to me that, like, I would, yes, of course, like, Miley Cyrus, this actual real musician, must be going, what is this? What the fuck is this? Like, yeah, which, yeah, not that, like, it was threatening in any way. I don't know about shaking, but it was like, oh, that must be a funny conversation that's happening with whoever else is in the top 10 right now.
After Pitch Perfect, though, I assume, like, the kind of a median Anna Kendrick fan, what they looked like, changed. I mean, it seems like you just engaged an entire new world of fans with that movie. Would you say, like, is that movie, like, a dividing point in your career? But, like, there's before Pitch Perfect and after Pitch Perfect in terms of how I am received and, you know, kind of what people expect from me in movies.
Yeah, I would definitely say that. I think I also, like, having a fan base that at that time was very much like sort of 12 to 14 year old girls. It felt like a very marked difference in, like, I'm really not that famous to, like, I'm super famous, because 12 to 14 year old girls will let you know, you know, like, if a 40 year old in a restaurant is like, oh, she was quite good and up in the air, she, like, you might never hear about it. But if you love Pitch Perfect and you're 12 years old, I'm going to hear about it. So it really did feel like, oh my God, like, what's happening? And it's obviously, like, very, very sweet. And I would see, these girls, like, get into, it was like, oh, I'm at the precipice of a huge fight between mother and daughter when the mom couldn't operate the phone. Like, right. When it's like, will you, and hand mom the phone. And, like, I could feel the meltdown of the girl standing next to me when it was like, I think I just took a picture of myself. Like, mom, you're ruining my life. So I felt like I was always trying to, like, mediate averting disaster between mother and daughter for a period of my life.
I feel like that's why so many people have reverted to, we're just going to take a selfie. You can see how the photo looks. You do it very quickly, and then you're on your way.
Yeah, I'll usually, like, if somebody's really nervous, I'll usually just, like, sort of gently steal the phone out of their hand and just do it for them, which, yeah.
I just want to say that there's a phone thief in West Hollywood, and I simply wouldn't be surprised if it were you, based on your experience now handling the phones.
Somebody's got to pay these gambling debts, Lewis. Come on.
I want to get into your latest film, Alice Darling, and just sort of ask, you know, like, we were just talking about the typical Anna Kendrick fan was after Pitch Perfect. And would you say that this was just a script that really spoke to you, or were you also making a conscious decision, you know, to sort of, like, do different roles than the Pitch Perfect universe that you'd been in?
Yeah. So my, we can keep it light, but my personal life kind of fell apart. My whole life kind of fell apart. And, it was a very similar thing to the content of Alice Darling. But, I think I also was just feeling like the idea of jumping back into something in the same tonal world as Pitch Perfect would have just felt impossible. And I was really drawn to movies like The Assistant and this movie Swallow. Just these really, really restrained, intimate films. And I feel like there is a set of tools that I will reach for when I'm on a set. And I don't want to denigrate any, you know, film or performance that I've done in the past. I'm very proud of those. But, and it was tools that I built intentionally because that's the kind of performer I wanted to be. But I think that I'd gotten myself to a place where I was really interested in making everybody at Video Village really happy. And like, I just wanted to be like the star student. And I got a lot of self-esteem out of being on set and being the person when like somebody else was maybe nervous in the scene or not doing well, that, you know, being the person that a producer would be like, oh, but we can always count on you, you know? And like, just knowing like, I can figure out what you guys want for the dailies and I can give you that. And sometimes I think that that wasn't serving the film or the performance as a whole. And I kind of went into Alice Darling as a sort of personal challenge to tolerate the experience that I knew would come of people being like, this is okay. Like, I'm not sure, you know, like the day to day of it wouldn't be quite so validating. Because I'm not being the kind of charismatic, like, I know the tool I have to reach for. I know what you want me to do, and I'm not going to do it. And I'm going to tolerate the discomfort of knowing that you don't think the scene's really working and trust that I'm building a whole performance. Because I think, like, especially the first 10 or 15 minutes of the film, Alice is kind of a bummer. Like, she's not really that fun to be around. You know, she's kind of cold to her friends and there's just not a lot of life behind her eyes. And I think I also wanted to, you know, trust that people would still root for her and get on board with her, because I kind of wanted to trust that I was still valid and deserved care when I was in that space. So it was important to me to not kind of come out as the, like, the pitch perfect Anna that you already are sort of invested in. And then, hey, see me in this emotionally abusive relationship. It was like, you know, sometimes when things are going really badly for a person, they suck to be around. That was, like, hard to not be getting the attaboys, that I usually try to kind of twist myself into being able to get every hour and every day and every scene, and kind of trust that I could see what I knew I wanted it to be, and then sort of hope that that felt like something to people when they watched it.
We should say that this is a movie about a girl who is in a relationship where she's being psychologically abused. And what shocked me, and you brought up a couple of movie titles just now, is I can't really think of too many movies about this subject. Like I can't in my head go to, like, oh, there's, I mean, like, you can, like, there's movies like Enough, you know, where, but that's a different type of movie entirely. Yeah. Like, you would never compare these two movies. I was wondering if it was intimidating to go into a movie that I don't really think has many predecessors.
I think a phrase that I used when I was talking to the director in the beginning was, I don't want to make a movie that I would have watched and gone, oh, okay, well, that's not happening, so I'm okay. Like, this relationship is fine. I guess this is just normal conflict. And I think that there was always a temptation with this movie to kind of take the easy way out and go, like, well, maybe just in one fight, he, like, shoves her into a wall. Because it makes the audience's job as a viewer a lot easier to just go, okay, we all agree he's the bad guy, she's the good guy, we're rooting for her. And to live in that discomfort and uncertainty for a big chunk of the movie is a lot to ask of an audience, but it's also really inviting them into the fucking experience of being in that position, in that relationship, because you are going, like, I don't know if I'm the problem, because I really think I might be the problem. And I think it's tricky to describe to people, and it was hard to continually push for pulling back on even the language that the partner uses, like how many times does he curse at her? And, you know, because again, it's like, it would be a lot easier if we just went, oh, okay, so he is abusive. And again, it was like something that I found myself really fighting for. And then of course going, well, I'm sort of fighting for my past self, you know, to go like, this is enough. Like what's happening in this movie is enough to say that this is abusive and she deserves to get out. You know, this isn't normal. This isn't normal conflict.
Would you happen to say that you maybe feel as if, you know, your profession as an actor, you know, sort of was maybe in sort of a hindrance and, you know, sort of this idea of, you know, needing to please people, even talking about the Valley Village thing, you know, like it's, did you feel that Alice Darling was able to afford you a bit of maybe catharsis that you hadn't experienced in other roles?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's exactly right. Like it's hard for me because in the same way that I'm very proud of this kind of tool set and I do love being like the pro, like, oh, she's such a pro, you know, on set. That's like, I remember telling my therapist, like somebody telling me you're really, really professional is like a bigger compliment to me than you're talented. So it's hard for me because I am, proud of that tool set and it can be armor. And it was very scary, but again, very valuable to me personally to take off all that armor. And I felt very lucky to be surrounded by people who were drawn to this movie because they'd also had similar experiences. And it felt like a very safe place to do that because everybody on set was like, yep, been there.
God, that sounds like, I mean, is that like luck? I mean, like how did this set come together? That seems like you must have been so grateful for that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that people who were drawn to this film were drawn to it for that reason. I think that on paper, I think that the experience of watching the movie is it's like a horror film, really. You know, like I kept saying when I was kind of advocating for pulling back on very black and white abusive behavior, I was like, nobody that's seen a cut of the film thinks like, I don't know, things seem fine for Alice. Like it's a very intense, horrifying movie.
Right.
I think that, but I will say that on paper, I could understand somebody who didn't relate to it, just kind of going like, nothing really happens in this movie. And because they didn't like read it and go, oh, I know this feeling. So I was very much not luck. I think it was everybody that showed up was very much there and passionate, from like the actors to like the makeup artists, you know, like my first day on set, I was like, oh, I've heard like 18 traumatizing stories today. This is, you know, this is like, let's go, let's do it. Let's get in there.
Well, that seems like such a great experience for you to have had. And I want to ask just a bit, lastly, about you have your directorial debut coming out soon, which, speaking of horror, is The Dating Game, but it's about the serial killer, Rodney Alcala.
Rodney Alcala,
Who was on The Dating Game, and I'm sure Lewis has seen this episode.
Oh, well, as you might know, Anna, I'm a bit of a game show historian, so this really speaks to me, yes.
That makes me very happy. Yeah, it's a movie about that incident. But it's sort of like from the perspective of the woman who went on the show. Yeah, it's a script I'd been attached to for a couple years. And then the opportunity to direct it came up very suddenly. And I sort of pushed myself off the cliff, which was totally terrifying. But I had so much fun. I had more fun than I've had in years. It was so awesome.
Because if I remember correctly, either the woman who went on the date or chose him or whatever said something like, or somebody turned him down and said, he felt like a serial killer to me. Like somebody had detected like to the T that he was crazy.
That's interesting. I don't know about, I mean, I'm embarrassed to say, if that's the case, I'm embarrassed to say, I don't know that quote, but I will say that there are so many insane details about the show and the case that really illuminate the way that women, even now, but especially at that time, would kind of go against their gut. And we've tried to sort of pack all of those specific details into the movie.
I cannot wait to see that.
Thank you.
What a perfect topic for a film. There's a few game show movies out there, and this is, I know, understand, barely a game show movie, but there's a couple tales out there that were supposed to have turned into movies that never did. There's this guy who won this game show, Press Your Luck, where he took the money, got it in ones, and he gamed the system. Anyway, there's a lot of, game shows attract a lot of strange personalities, is what I'm saying. So,
clearly.
Congrats to you.
It's not shocking, too, when you consider, you know, like the proliferation of, I guess, you know, like scammers on like Bravo or Real Housewives or something, you know? It's like, it's, I think that when you look back to things like this, people like that are just sort of drawn to TV and attention in general. And they're always going to find a way to be front and center while thinking that they're hiding something.
Yeah, what kind of pathology lurks beneath somebody who would go on a game show or be an actress or host a podcast? Dear God.
Well, now that we're smithereens, okay.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
I'm so delighted to meet you guys. I'm such a big fan of both of you, and I'm so happy that you guys had me.
Yeah, and thank you for sharing all of that with us, too. Like, you know, really, I really hope people see Alice Darling, because I think that you are fantastic in it.
Thank you.
And I want to add one quick note. Years ago, I posted something about the singer Laura Nyro on Twitter, and Anna responded something about, I don't know, wanting to play Laura Nyro or something.
Oh,
I just
want
to say the taste level involved with loving Laura Nyro, you're one of the real ones.
My God. I actually put, I don't know if this, because, you know, we're just starting to edit the movie, and you have to know that, like, it will tell you what it needs to be and who knows what it's going to be. But Catherine Gallagher is in the movie, and I asked her to sing something in the shower, and I was like, oh, will you sing Poverty Train by Laura Nyro? Because I was like, I just want to, like, you know, and I was like, that was something that came out around that time, and the lyrics were sort of, I don't know, whatever. But yeah, I was like desperately trying to put her in the movie somehow.
Oh, yes. You've added another year to my life.
You're like a mushroom in Super Mario for Lewis.
Yeah, I've tripled in size.
That's how I feel about your Twitter. I'm like, I feel like Lewis wrote this tweet for me, just for me, audience of one.
Honestly, it could be, basically. I'm looking at the demographics, and it might just be you. So, yeah. Also, whatever you said about showing my Twitter to Shirley MacLaine, my life's not the same. Please know that I've...
Oh, okay, yes, yeah, okay. Because, I guess I did say that in an...
Something... It was, okay, it blew my mind.
Because I was like, maybe at some point I'll go on they'd have me on the podcast and, you know, I could tell them then or whatever, but I'm glad that reached you because, yeah, I don't know how much I actually said about it. What did I say?
It was super brief. It was like, oh, I wanted to explain to Shirley MacLaine what Twitter was. So I showed her like this, you know, this gay guy's tweets that are sometimes about Hollywood. Yeah.
Is that how I explained it? Well, yeah.
Some gay guy. Yeah, right.
Because I was like, she was asking me about Twitter and, like, you know, what is it even for and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, I'll show her some Lewis Rochelle tweets and whatever. And I was like going through some of them, like looking for a winner. I think I was going mainly through the ones that I had like liked. And, and she was still kind of like, okay, I don't get it. What? Huh? And then it was, I think it was this tweet that I'll now remember forever because I, you know, Shirley MacLaine was like repeating it back to me. She was like, this one about Christine Baranski, explain that to me. Like where you'd said something about like, if this weather gets any more severe, it would be Christine Baranski in a turtleneck.
And what's wrong with me, damn it?
And she said, what is that? What is that? What is that? And I just went, well, because, you know, Christine Baranski in a turtleneck, that's quite severe. So the weather, you know, like a joke, you know? And she was like, okay. And like a couple minutes went by and she was sitting next to me and then she went, Christine Baranski in a turtleneck. Wonderful.
Oh my God.
I love that.
Yes. Oh, fuck yes.
And I do remember thinking, one day I'm going to tell him that story.
Oh my God. Unfortunately, you added 3 years to my life. And in fact, an entire other life since it was Shirley MacLaine. So
I love that.
All right. Thank you for being here. Like,
yeah, thank
person.
You.
Of course. Thank you, guys.
Alice Darling is exclusively in AMC theaters nationwide January 20th, 2023. When we're back, keep it. And we are back with our favorite segment of the episode, Keep It, the first official Keep Its of 2023. Lewis.
Yes.
Why don't you go first?
Okay, I'm starting with the reversal. Because I think people expect us to bring up the new show, The Real Friends of WeHo, which, first of all, can we get another pitch on the title? The Real Friends?
I have heard...
First of all, you know they're not even real friends, so don't even say real friends. Use some other term.
I have heard that it was initially supposed to be a reboot of The A-List.
Which, as God intended, as we all know, we watched every episode of that show. I watched New York and Dallas, don't you worry. But my keep it is not to this show. There's some like blow up on Twitter just about, oh no, it's gays sort of pretending to have drama with each other to imitate the housewives, which they actually love, who actually belong on TV. Couple things. One, the star of the show is Brad Goreski. I would say Brad Goreski is one of the funniest reality stars of the past 20 years. I think if you're going to be critical of the show, you have to first give him his props, which is to say, The Rachel Zoe Project was an A. When that show was on, it had no right to be that funny. Everybody on that show belonged there. Rachel Zoe, hilarious. What was her sister's assistant's name? Taylor. She was great. Brad was great. Dressed great. So I feel like, first of all, you can't just dismiss this show out of hand. Because also, first of all, shows like this are going to exist every couple of years. There's always going to be, we're going to make the attempt at gay people hanging out, right? There should be the definitive version of that show, and we still don't really have it yet. So I respect the attempt, and I wish people would give it two episodes before we throw it in the pit with Finding Prince Charming or whatever else is down there. You know?
I would say that, you know, like, obviously gays are more critical of other gays than they are right. of other entertainment. And I'm intrigued for the show, if only because of the production company behind it is truly original. And they produce Real Housewives of Potomac, Summer House, Shots of Sunset. You know, so, like, they know what they're doing in the game. You know, they've produced mm-hmm. some of the recent seasons of Atlanta. You know, like Real Housewives of Atlanta. And so the pedigree is there. I think that if you, reality shows are always about gathering the right personalities, you know, like you're going to need someone who's going to be annoying but fun. You're really going to, I think that what the show is really going to need is someone who's a quote unquote producer, you know, mm-hmm. like the best reality shows like that always do well when there's someone who knows when they come to meet with everybody, like, we're making a TV show. It's not just hanging yeah. out. It's not just creating drama. It is, what's the purpose of the scene and what am I getting out of it? And some of the people we don't know, which I think is great, because one criticism I was seeing from people online was, who are these gays? And, like, using, like, even the Jennifer Coolidge meme from White Lotus, like, do you know these gays? Which, side note, side keep it to, if I hear one more person use these gays, they're trying to murder me again, like, give it a rest.
Right. Also, that was the most blatant, like, meme pull on White Lotus, and then you went and fucking did it. It's like, don't be a child. Like again, it was funny for a millisecond. Move on.
You're murdering yeah. me now.
us, the viewer of your meme.
But the point of a show like this isn't you're supposed to know all these people. Like,
right.
like we don't know all the fucking housewives when they start on a show, you know? And it's like, listen, I know gays like to play with their Barbie dolls, you know, and share memes of women and watch them tear each other down. But, you know, like, maybe we can let gays do that too, you know?
Right.
And if these people are awful, so are a lot of the fucking housewives that we like, okay? And at least we know that these gays didn't vote for Trump.
Right. You think, I mean,
presumably,
we'll see.
Presumably.
But yes, but you're right. We have the right to be as idiotic as the housewives. We still need that show where we prove just how low we can go.
I would say that the one thing I do sort of like wish the show sort of was, like, because I would love like a gay sort of housewives show, but I think that like what really pulls you into those shows is like a community and a place that you haven't seen. I'm sure the vitriol will still maybe be there if it weren't like WeHo, you know, but I do think some of the response is also just because it feels more like a vapid gays and WeHo TV show that's also taking time away from Drag Race. The Drag Race component is annoying people too, because you know gays love 7 hours of Drag Race every Friday.
Right, yeah. They sit down. It's fully like a David Lean experience. You don't leave the theater until you're 4 hours in. Yeah.
But, you know, I think like a community in like Orange County or something like of gays, you know, like people we really don't know, but are just sort of awful people. That's what I want to see.
Right. I think there is potential there. I think you're right. I will
also
say,
Todrick.
I think
I'm sorry. Like the worst part of the show is going to be Todrick because I don't want to see him on TV.
But man, I really can't think of too many celebrities who went on a reality show and came out looking worse than his Big Brother experience. It's interesting. But I want to say, I do think there is something interesting about housewives. Like, they as characters, like, they have a husband, they have a kid, like, they have, like, a household to defend, a status to defend. Whereas gays, like, not that they can't be married and not that they can't have kids, but it feels like there's less stakes. Like, they have less reason to be melodramatic. I'm not saying I'm voting down the show for this reason, but it will be interesting to see what mix of gays will make a show like this work.
Well, that's also why I suggested, like if you had a community in like a city that we don't know, as well as like WeHo, which is like with a very stereotypical like gays trying to be famous in LA thing. Because I'm like, that level of quote unquote status just feels like played out to me. I think that there are plenty of gays that could be in a show like across America where they're fighting for some of that status and things that the housewives are. Because like, what does status mean to like gays with money in like San Antonio or like Chicago or something? And like the status isn't related to, am I famous online or like gonna like book this role or like gonna be on this red carpet? The status is, you know, like, I'm wealthy and I want to keep that wealth. Or, you know, like, what is my standing in this community? Or, you know, like, gays with real jobs, like a doctor or like a plastic surgeon or something like that. Like, what the status, I think, comes from the community you're in, but also your job and like how you maintain your life and like how you make your money. And this show just feels very, it's uninteresting, you know, because like the search for fame is just sort of, who cares?
And also, everybody kind of has it. Like, everybody's famous for a little while, et cetera.
You know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. No one is paying for their fame in sweat on this show, okay? Because fame costs.
Do you work for Ease Mysteries and Scandals from the year 1999? Are you host AJ Benza? Ira, what is your keep it?
My keep it this week goes to Rihanna.
Oh, now she is a one-time singer who is now singing again.
Yeah. She's lifting it up, okay? Right.
She arguably lifted it up. I put it down gently. I haven't thought about it since. But
I put it down, said, please do not flip it or reverse it. We're good. We're good here. Now, my keep it goes to Rihanna because I just discovered that I was being scammed by her.
What?
And Savage Fenty. Apparently, there's a lawsuit pending against Savage Fenty for scamming people by having them sign up for a quote-unquote VIP membership whenever they buy something. So what happened is last year, I bought some silk boxers Fenty and like a mesh tank top.
Right, you're going out.
Little did I know, my card was being charged $50 every month for a membership that I never even knew I signed up for because it was in the fine print.
Oh, wow. That's a lot of money to tack onto a boxer's bill.
That is okay, Rihanna. Like, you're Jin Shah. I feel preyed upon.
Yeah.
And it's also, like, it's also that unfortunate that I used a card that, like, I don't really use. Because, like, I didn't notice it until, like, I was checking, like, my finances and taxes, like, end of the year. I was like, where the fuck is this charge coming from? And I go online and I find out that many other people have been susceptible to this. And that's why there's the lawsuit because, it was found that it was an unsavory business practice.
Wow. I'm getting visions of, you know, how the Celine Dion fans protested outside of the offices of Rolling Stone because she wasn't included in the 200 greatest singers list. I think the Savage Fenty buyers need to be outside a certain Super Bowl. I think that's what I want to see.
Keep it, listeners. If you too have been scammed like me, meet me in Arizona where we will get justice.
Oh my
Dial
God.
1-800 justice from Rihanna.
I was waiting for the bubble print to appear under your face. Check her money order, whatever. Yeah.
And then like a scrolling thing where it's like, you may not actually get justice from Rihanna by partaking in Ira Madison III's justice.
Oh my God, that is really unusual. I mean, I what can I say? I'm disappointed in Rihanna.
I haven't been scammed like this since I signed up for the Kardashian credit card. I never did that.
I mean, it's right there in the name. Sorry.
I never did that. But do you remember when they had a credit card?
Oh, that's it's giving Trump vodka. It's ew.
All right. Well, that's our show this week. Except there'll be a bonus episode out later today.
That's right.
About the Golden Globes.
So if you were disappointed with what we dished, it's incomplete. And trust me, it can get so much worse.
Yeah. I mean, I'm waiting for like a Aaron Taylor Johnson type win.
I know. That's what the Golden Globes used to be for. Like salmon fishing in the Yemen. Are you going to pull this off? Who knows?
A film that I only remember because of the Globes. I've never seen it, but I know that title because of the Globes.
Mozart in the Jungle, etc. Right.
I think people watched that, didn't they?
I find that presumptuous. There's no way of knowing. And they won't admit it if you ask.
Well, thank you to Anna Kendrick for joining us. And thank you for joining us for season 6 of Keep It. Is this like a Community thing, 6 seasons in a movie?
Right. Oh, good Lord. What's the movie going to be? And is Lucas Hedges available?
To play you?
Yeah, I think it has to be Lucas.
Who's B? Brian Tyree.
We'll let the viewers decide. I don't hate that.
Winston Duke. We'll go with one of those.
Brian Tyree, by the way, fabulous in Causeway, a movie we forgot to bring up.
Yeah, well, he is fabulous in it. I think J-Law, is nice to see her back on screen again. I think it's a good movie that doesn't have a lot of awards conversation because it's ultimately just sort of there.
It doesn't feel like a competitive movie. It's just good. Yeah,
it's just good. Mm-hmm. You're just hanging out.
Right. Just like on Keep It. See you next week or tonight.
Yeah. Keep It, the Causeway of Podcasts. And that is our episode. Don't forget to listen to our Golden Globes special later today. And also remember to check out full episodes of Keep It on the Uncultured YouTube channel. And to please rate and review Keep It on your podcast platform of choice, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, etc. 5-star reviews. If it's got to be 4 stars, I don't want it. See you on the next Keep It. Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James. Our producer is Chris Lord. And our associate producer is Malcolm Whitfield. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III, that's me, and Louis Vertel. This episode was recorded and mixed by Evan Sutton. Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nar Malconian, and Delon Villanueva for production support every week. And as always, Keep It is filmed in front of a live studio audience.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across 6 Southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th, watch Long Play Series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.